Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to History Hack. If you didn't know by now, we are the revolution. That means we're sharp, witty, lots of fun, but it also means that we're essentially the peasants in Les Mis huddled round a table in the corner of the bar with no money. If you enjoy the show, please do support us. We have a Patreon account by which you can donate a small monthly sum in appreciation of what you're hearing. Alternatively, we have Ko-fi, in which you can just do a one-off donation as a thank you if you particularly enjoy a certain episode. Either way, we massively appreciate all of your support. Hope you enjoy the show.
Hello and welcome to another episode of History Hack. I'm doing things slightly different and I'm working with someone I haven't worked with in a long time. I am working with the fabulous Charlie. Charlie, how are you doing?
I'm very good, Chris, my boaty friend. How are you?
I'm doing very well, thank you. Good to see you. We're not touching on boats. Well, briefly touching on a boat today, but not many. So who have we got on today and what are we talking about?
Well, we're very lucky today to have a repeat offender joining us here on History Hack. We've got the wonderful Michelle Schindler. She's a medieval historian who specialises in the later medieval period. And we've already had her on to talk about her first book, Lovell Our Dog, who is basically just Richard III's ride or die best friend, Francis Lovell. But she's here today to talk to us all about her second book, De La Pole, Father and Son, The Duke, the Heir and the Struggle for Power. Hi, Michelle. How are you?
Hello. Thank you for having me again. I hope you're all fine.
Oh, we're really good. We're so excited to have you back, Michelle. You know that you are in very safe company here. A lot of Yorkists in the room.
That's good. They don't want to argue.
No. We're very much Team White Rose here. But let's get into the De La Poles. At the time of John De La Pole's birth, what was his family position in the nobility? What are they up to at this time?
Well, they were very much to the fore at court at that time when John De La Pole was born. And John's father, especially William De La Pole, was favored a lot by King Henry VI. It's often been said that he was some sort of a father figure for the king. Mm. And at the time of John's birth, though, the first cracks were starting to appear. There were voices that William was being too powerful, that Alice especially also was being too powerful, that's John's mother, taking on a position that's not suited to a woman, and that they both were leading the king and not in directions that were best for England, but that were best for them. And, it was not yet dangerous for them, but it was starting to go there at the time of John's birth.
As you said, it does start to degrade quite nastily. And what does happen to William De La Pole?
Well, simply put, he became too powerful. Plus, Henry VI's reign was starting to become more difficult, going in a direction that really wasn't all that good. The situation for England in Europe became worse, especially during the last phase of the Hundred Years' War. And William especially was seen as a figurehead for that for two reasons. First of all, he was sort of the main courtier at Henry VI's court. So it was always great to blame him rather than the king for it. Mm-hmm. And secondly, William especially was seen as openly favoring peace in France. And he did. This is not disputed. From a modern point of view, he was completely right. He himself had fought in France for well over a decade. He'd been imprisoned, he'd been injured, he'd lost his father and all his four brothers in France, two in battle, two in captivity. So it makes perfect sense he wanted peace. And as an experienced fighter, he probably also saw the writing on the wall, saw that it wasn't going to become better for England, that it was time to cut their losses. But it wasn't a popular opinion. And due to this being known, due to him saying this again and again, and due to him being close to Henry VI, all of the king's unpopular positions became being blamed on William. Also, the unpopular marriage to Margaret of Anjou, which meant losses for England in France, most notably Anjou, was also blamed on him because he had been the man who had negotiated this marriage. Of course, he couldn't have done this without the complete support of Henry VI himself. He couldn't have said, oh, well, I'm just giving up these parts of lands without royal support, but, well, he was being blamed. Moreover, Henry favored William extremely, and even in 1448, he made him a duke, and a position that had been previously reserved for royalty, brothers, uncles, nephews of the king. So a lot of nobility, the more old established nobility, would have been upset about this. And even more so because William, though he was an earl, had inherited the title, was actually of singularly low birth for the nobility of the time, his family being descended from wool merchants. So naturally, this caused even more anger in the people who figured they should, they were more deserving of this this sort of title and this sort of favor. And eventually, the anger against Henry and especially his court became so bad that men close to him and William were actually murdered on the street, Adam Molins being one such man. And so something had to be done. And the mob was screaming for William's blood. So he was imprisoned and accused of treason. He was accused of absolutely everything his enemies could think of, from trying to make the French king king of England to having seduced a nun.
Oh, brilliant.
Completely irrelevant stuff in parts, but mud sticks. And Henry VI could eventually see to it that the treason charges did not stick, but he couldn't save William completely. So he was declared guilty of lesser charges and sentenced to 5 years in exile. And this was a move almost certainly meant to protect William more than anything else. And William duly made to relieve England, but he never left the country. His ship was intercepted. He was subjected to a mock trial and then beheaded with a rusty sword. There's a lot of detail about this in the Paston letters. And he was threatened with his men being hurt if he tried to defend himself. So he just let it happen. After his death, his body was then stripped of all valuables. And after that, it was dumped at a beach. And this is often claimed to have been done by an angry mob, and the angry mob was certainly screaming for his blood. But it has to be pointed out that the ship which intercepted William's ship was a royal one, so it would have to have been commanded by someone in power. We don't know who exactly, but Richard, Duke of York, is the most popular candidate, the one who's most often blamed.
Ah, well, we like to blame the Richards of York for a lot of things that go wrong this time. This is, I mean, my goodness, what a roller coaster ride. It reminds me, hearing this, you know, looking a little bit later, that idea of someone getting above their station, getting too close to the king, and then being blamed for everything that's going wrong. This feels like Thomas Cromwell in the 16th century. This feels like Thomas Wentworth, Earl of Strafford in the 17th century, Charles I's advisor. This does feel like a bit of a theme. So poor old William.
Yeah, it's a thing. Thomas Becket in the 12th century as well, even before he became Archbishop. It's a thing that happened, yeah.
It's just a thing. So how did William's death affect John de la Pole and the rest of the family? I really want to hear about Alice. She sounds amazing.
Alice is great. Yeah, at first it was a disaster. Alice was really uncommonly powerful, even for any man, but especially for a woman. She was known to have a big influence on Henry VI, have supported her husband completely, and she as well was being, fairly low-born, her being the granddaughter of Geoffrey Chaucer, the poet, who was a Winter's son himself, so yeah. So again, we have this idea of a woman rising above her station and then a commoner rising above her station. So, people weren't happy. So Alice was seen as being complicit in William's supposed crimes, and she was hated as well. Shortly after William's death, the so-called Jacquard Rebellion began, and the rebels demanded, one of their key demands was that several people be no longer allowed access to the king to not influence him, that some of these people be tried for treason. Alice was among them, and she was the only woman who was on that list. It was therefore a pretty fraught summer for William's family. There were also threats against William's body even. And it seems as if Alice had her son, that's John de la Pole, brought to court after learning of William's death. and Henry VI was probably, although we don't know for certain, John's godfather, so it was the safest place he could be. John himself was only 7 years old, and it may have occurred to some people to harm him as some sort of twisted payback to his parents, but nobody would have been so eager to hurt an innocent kid to try and attack the royal residences for it. So John was sort of out of the picture. Mm-hmm. While Alice saw to it that her husband was buried properly and tried and saved herself, and she succeeded. It all ended well for her. She was not accused of treason, and she was not barred from accessing the king either. But, there he is again. But while she occasionally came to court after her husband's death, most of her and John's time after his death was spent in their own belongings. Maybe she was trying to distance herself and try and be there for her son and not have him associated with that scandal.
Just absolutely just fascinating amount of stuff going on. I mean, talk about being cursed to live in interesting times. So when John does come of age, he's... The whole country is now in civil war, brutal civil war between the houses of Lancaster and York. So, did John de la Pole pick a side? How did he pick a side? How does anybody?
Well, he did pick a side, but he did it comparatively late. And as early as February 1458, his mother, Alice again, and Richard, Duke of York, had decided that John and Richard's second oldest daughter, Elizabeth, were to marry. And they married almost certainly in that February after the contracts were signed. They appear to have had a pretty good marriage. But when it started, they were 15 and 13 years old, respectively. So they just continued living with Alice for a while and probably were influenced by her. But despite these family ties due to marriage, John kept out of battles and picking sides for a while. By late 1460, there was murmuring he should already pick a side and declare himself, but he didn't do so until Richard, Duke of York, was dead. He first fought at the First Battle of St. Albans, which might be the first battle he could muster enough men for after Richard's death. But there's a note of interest here. He did not fight at the Battle of Mortimer's Cross on 2nd February 1461, the first battle of that year. It may have simply been because he did not have enough men yet, because it was only a month after Richard's death. But it's notable that at the end of October or early November 1468, John's first child, his daughter Elizabeth, was born. So we know exactly what he was doing instead of fighting in early February 1461. Anyway, we don't actually know why he chose sides so late, but it may have been that he himself blamed Richard, Duke of York, for his father's death and didn't want to fight for him. Or maybe he just thought it was when Richard died, his son Edmund also died. And that seems to have been a point when a lot of people were turned against the Lancastrians, and maybe so did John. We just can't know. From that time on, he always fought until the Yorkist, until he was critically injured at the Battle of Hexham in 1464, after which he never fought again.
So much to take in there, isn't there? I mean, it's interesting that he seems to be a lover, not a fighter.
Yeah. He didn't seem to have been a fighter, really. He did when he had to, but not his thing.
So while he was doing his loving, what was his family life like?
It seems to have been unusually close. He and his wife Elizabeth had like 70 children, 13 actually. Their first child was born when she was 17 and he was 19, and their last when she was 40 and he was 42. And their children were close to him and to adulthood. The oldest and most famous son, that's John, Earl of Lincoln, never had his own household, continuing to live with his parents into adulthood. So did his older sister Elizabeth and her husband Henry Lord Morley. John was a good father. He was a good father figure too for some of the wards they had. And the household was one of education, and it seems to have been quite happy. Elizabeth was known to be able to influence him, maybe the only person who could. So it seems they had a happy life.
I mean, I guess it was happy until he fell out with rather powerful East Anglian family over land holdings, I understand. And this goes on for years and years, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. He had pretty much inherited this quarrel already. His father, William, and John Payston, the oldest, there are three John Paystons in this, they had already had huge arguments, and John would continue them. They kept arguing about several manors, valuable manors, but not really so valuable you would think they would be worth a family feud spanning decades. But apparently it was.
Where were they in East Anglia, these manors?
Oh, I have no idea. When I wrote this book, we were in lockdown, so I couldn't go visit it.
I only asked because I'm from the area, so I thought, oh,
yeah, some of them were in Oxfordshire, I know. But some of them were in Suffolk, but where exactly, I really don't know. Helston was one of them. I don't know where this is. Drayton was another one.
We'll get you over and we'll go on the tour.
Yeah. So, John and the Payson family blamed each other for absolutely every minor thing that went wrong. One of them had been told a sheep was missing, the other one must have stolen it. It was mostly minor stuff like that, though there were some bigger attacks on the manors, and in one notable instance, John's men sacked the church, and this caused Payson to gleefully comment that words to the effect of, "This clown can't even control his own men." the quarrel is usually told from the point of view of the Paystons, because we have it in their letters and we don't have John's take on the whole situation. But even in the letters, it becomes clear that there's a lot of people sided with either side, so it wasn't that clear cut. Nor were such quarrels particularly uncommon, but it's notable about that it's very hard not to get the impression both John and all the Paystons involved, and all called John just because, that they actually had a lot of fun with this. In one recorded instance, John, Duke of Suffolk, arrived at one of the disputed manors, that's Helston, which was held by John Payston at the time, and ate almost all the fish stored there, so just so John Paston wouldn't have any left when he came to visit.
Oh my God. Just so he couldn't have any, he ate all the fish.
Yeah, both John Paston Sr. and John Paston Jr., or the middle Paston, mentioned John in their wills too. It's quite fascinating. It's hilarious.
My goodness.
We've all had neighbours like that, though, haven't we?
Yeah.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
But he also has other troubles, because as the rebel king's brother-in-law, things must have been quite tense when Henry VI came back on the throne. And did he go into exile with Edward IV?
No, he didn't. He apparently managed to keep his head down. It was his wife, Elizabeth, who was, of course, the sister of the rebel king and Richard, then Duke of Gloucester. And she was in contact with her brothers in exile and supposedly helped convince their brother George, Duke of Clarence, to change side and support Edward's bid to take back the throne. It's known that Margaret did, that's the Duchess of Burgundy, but the other sisters, that's Anne, Duchess of Exeter, and, Elizabeth, they were all in contact with their brothers. And she and John stayed in Suffolk at that time, and almost certainly, since they were close to the sea, it was her who led on the messages to Burgundy and back from Burgundy. John is never mentioned in this context, but it's quite hard not to see how he could not have known what went on in his household. But since he didn't get involved, he probably had plausible deniability should Elizabeth be discovered. But we don't really know what he did there. We just know it went on in his household.
I guess there's so much back and forth, especially when you've seen I can't remember what the name of it is. When Henry VI comes back, there's a name for it.
Re-adeption.
That's it, re-adeption. So I'm thinking restoration, which is something completely different, much later.
Different, yeah.
So they've already seen, you know, a rebel king come in, depose a king, and then that deposed king come back and depose a rebel king. I can understand why people don't want to show their hand at this time, because you don't know which is going to be the winning side. You don't know what's going to happen to you. So I think keeping your head down is a pretty smart move at this time.
Yeah, especially if you maybe don't particularly care. If it's one king, if it's the other king, who cares? Especially since Edward wasn't particularly nice to him. Maybe he wasn't. What do I care?
But John Duke of Suffolk goes on to serve the Yorkist cause, doesn't he? How successful is he at this?
He was not a very important man, but I think from his point of view, he was quite successful. He was a local magnate. He could cheerfully quarrel with the patrons all he wanted. And whenever it was needed, he was there to serve king and country. Though, as mentioned before, he could not fight again after 4064. Edward did not treat him very well, but, well, I guess being a somewhat disliked brother-in-law of the king is still a position many, many men would have died for. And I think John was happy enough with what he had. He had a somewhat more important role in Richard III's reign, but it wasn't because of his own action. It was because of his son, and his daughter Anne was engaged to the Scottish crown prince at the time. And it was, of course, dissolved when Henry VII came to the throne.
John, Earl of Lincoln, the second John, becomes quite important during the reign of good King Richard, doesn't he?
Yeah, he was even described as Richard's friend by the ambassador Nicholas von Poplau. He was president of the Council of the North, and when Richard's only legitimate son, Edward of Middleham, died, he even became Richard's heir presumptive. This was, of course, not due to any of his own actions. It's often claimed that Richard probably chose him, but Richard couldn't choose any more than your current king can choose Prince William as his heir. It's just the laws of inheritance, and according to those laws, Lincoln was Richard's heir. But Lincoln was quite a popular man, and he actually got very well in his position of President of Council of the North. He even got on very well with Henry Percy, Earl of Northumberland, who was not exactly the Yorkist's biggest fan. It is notable, however, that Lincoln was only in his early 20s, and there are some ordinances Richard laid down for him as President of Council of the North, which suggests he had quite a streak of mischief. For example, it's pointed out that when he goes hunting, he has to pay for his own food and not dine out on government dime, and that he is not to have two breakfasts ordered. And you get something of the impression of Richard desperately attempting to close all loopholes as Lincoln's happily skipped through them all, like some sort of university student, maybe.
Oh my goodness. I adore this family. I just think they are fascinating and underexplored. So having been a favourite of Richard III, how does John of Lincoln find life under Henry Tudor?
That's maybe the most interesting part, because Henry loved him. He trusted him as he trusted no other, pretty much. It really startled me when I started researching it. You'd think Henry would have been wary of him, but after all, with Richard dead, before Henry changed the law in his parliament in November 1485, Lincoln was de jure king. But Henry seems to have immediately taken to him. He didn't even ask him to swear fealty until after that parliament, together with the Earl of Oxford and his own uncle, Jasper Tudor, who had been in exile with him. In the first years of Henry's reign, Lincoln was very much to the fore. He received a position of honor at the christening of Henry's son, Prince Arthur, pretty much the only one who wasn't very closely related to him. He was even one of the few asked to try and find rebels in 1486. He got to keep most of the honors given to him by Richard, except the ones connected with being heir. It's notable in itself, but it becomes even more notable, realizing that there's evidence Lincoln was involved in plotting against Henry from December 1485. Mm-hmm. And that also tells us a lot about Lincoln, and it's perhaps not the most flattering even, though it's extraordinarily impressive. He must have been really one hell of an actor to keep Henry so happy with him, so trusting, while even plotting against him. But it also tells us just how much Lincoln must have hated him. He was always in Henry's presence, acting as if he was his friend, and all the while plotting his death.
You can see why the Tudors were paranoid, can't you?
Yeah. Actually, that's even recorded contemporarily that Henry, after Stoke, he said he would never trust again. So you can see why.
Gosh. So tell us about the end of John Lincoln. How does his story end?
Well, he eventually he openly declared against Henry VII. That was in early 1487, and he went to Burgundy to his aunt Margaret, Duchess of Burgundy, or the widowed Duchess of Burgundy, really. And she and Francis Lovell, about whom my first book is about, had been planning a rebellion with the help of Margaret's son-in-law, Maximilian, who would go on to become Holy Roman Empire a couple decades later, and Irish support as well. They had a pretender, a young boy who we actually don't know who he claimed who he was. Well, the traditional version is that he claimed to be Edward Earl of Warwick, but there is really no reason why Lincoln would have rebelled for Edward Earl of Warwick, either a real one or a fake one. So there's a theory, especially proposed these days by Matt Lewis, that he was actually claimed, or actually was, Edward V. Well, we don't know. But, They started this rebellion, and it eventually culminated in the Battle of Stoke, and Lincoln died at that battle. Again, interesting, it's contemporarily that Henry wanted him to live, and Virgil actually claimed, Polydore Virgil, writing a bit later, that Henry's men were desperate for him to die already because they were afraid that Henry would give him back all the favor.
Wow. Wow. He must have been charming.
Very.
Because, I mean, we've spoken to the wonderful, friend of the show, Matt Lewis, chair of the Richard III Society, about this and about his book, The Survival of the Princes in the Tower. And his suggestion is that in 1487, the only person with a better Yorkist claim to the throne than John de la Pole, Earl of Lincoln, would be Edward V. So yeah. Why is he going to go fight and get himself killed for some Irish pretender? They must have believed that boy was still alive to fight for him. So it's really interesting. What do you think?
I don't know. I just know the traditional version, it just can't be, because for one thing, it requires that the Earl of Lincoln is bilocating, because he both leaves court in early February and takes this low-born boy from Oxford with him, and at the same time, he's still there when that low-born boy is announced in Burgundy and can judge that the real Earl of Lincoln is there, and this cannot be. It physically cannot be. And I think it's probably the version that answers the most question is that, yes, it was Edward V. I wouldn't want to be definite on this, but the other versions don't make as much sense. This one also leaves some questions open, but I guess at a distance of over 500 years, anything will.
That's really exciting. But you're very good at finding historical children yourself, Michelle, because you, since we spoke about Francis Lovell, you found something else, didn't you?
Yeah, I found a reference to a daughter of Francis Lovell, and it's always assumed, and I always assumed as well, that he never had any children, but he did. There's a daughter in the Paston letters, very obscure, often in abridged version, it's cut out, called Agnes. And there's also a reference that said Agnes had a brother, but no name, sadly. So yeah, there would have been two children who sadly died before 1485, probably before 1484. But yeah, she was called Agnes. We don't know his name.
And then afterwards, I know it's not covered in the book, but the rest of the de la Pole family, his brother, John's brothers, they fall foul of possibly one of the worst kings of England, don't they?
Yes. Actually, it's interesting because what's covered in the book is John Sr., John Duke of Suffolk, actually survived his oldest son. And he was also favored by Henry for reasons nobody knows. And he did his usual thing. He even, maybe 2 years later, he was invited to a festivity by Henry VII. And he actually said, "It's not lavish enough for me," and just didn't come. And he didn't get punished. He died in his bed, but then his heir was John's younger brother, Edmund. And, well, he at first, he got demoted to Earl of Suffolk, and a lot of his belongings were confiscated. Then Edmund went and sued. He said, "I'm either staying an earl or I'm losing all these possessions, but not both." And then he won in court and got his possessions back. That's, yeah, the Della Poles, they were great. And but at some point he got accused of having murdered somebody. It's all a bit sketchy. We don't really know what happened. And eventually he and his youngest brother, Richard, born in just after Richard III died, and then his mother, Elizabeth, and of course his father, John, went and named him Richard, just after Henry had come to the throne. That's brilliant, isn't it? Anyway, the two of them rebelled against Henry VII, and they fled to exile. And there was another brother, William, and he got imprisoned. He wasn't even involved, but he got imprisoned. And he stayed in prison for, I think, 37 years, longest prisoner in the history of the Tower, despite having done exactly nothing, just because of his association. The other two, Edmund, was eventually returned to England, stayed in the Tower as well, and got executed by Henry VIII. Supposedly, Henry VII told him to have him executed on his deathbed, but since he was only executed 4 years after Henry VII died, I don't think we can blame him for that. and Richard actually never returned to England. He was called the Last White Rose, and he was claiming to be King of England for quite a while. He also called himself Duke of Suffolk, and all the rest of Europe did as well. Just like, we are not accepting that thing that he was demoted. No. And, he was quite impressive. One time, Henry VIII, who you understand why he hated him, because he said his throne belonged to him, sent a spy. And then Richard turned the spy and sent him back to England to spy on Henry.
Brilliant. Again, they're charming, aren't they? There must have been something about the De La Poles that was irresistible.
Absolutely, yeah. We don't know what, but you get the impression that they are just very charming. A lot of joy de vivre, I would say, with them. Yeah. Richard eventually died at the Battle of Pavia in, I think, 1525.
Wow. Well, Michelle, this has been really, really interesting. I do enjoy later Middle Age dynasticism. so cutthroat and so much backstabbing and people with amazing charisma. But could you remind everyone what the book's title is and where they can get it, please?
Yes, of course. The book's title is De La Pole, Father and Son, The Duke, the Earl, and the Struggle for Power. And they can get it off the Amberley website. Well, pre-order it. It's out in 2 weeks. Off Amazon, I guess, and any bookstore. In Britain anyway. It's only out here in Germany in 3 months.
Well, we'll take full advantage of that.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, and I'll speak to the powers to get it up on the History Hack bookshop. That way, not only do we get a small slice of the money, you get a bigger slice of the money, and Jeff Bezos can't use it for rocket fuel.
So thank you. The winner.
Our incredible guests give us 45 minutes of their time to join us and talk about their work or their new book. This is just a small taster. As a result, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org, where you can find our guests' latest books, you can support them, and you can support us on History Hack. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep going and bring you more top-of-the-line guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/History Hack, or search for us in the shop section. Thank you so much for your continued support. We really appreciate our listeners and supporters. So make sure you get down to the bookshop and grab yourselves a new book.